Welcome back in to the podcast. So great to have you here on a Monday, and it's fantastic to bring on a first-time podcast guest, someone who I've actually kind of hoped to get on for about a year now, but he's moving all over the country doing all sorts of college hoop stuff and NBA scouting stuff. He is the go-to guy for so many reasons for ESPN on college basketball and NBA draft. Fran Fraschilla is joining the podcast. How you doing, Fran? And is this a rare night? I'm catching you at home during the college basketball season right now.
You know what? I'm out getting a pizza so that I can get back and watch some basketball. But my travels start up very shortly. I get really busy, and I've got to balance that and a senior in high school who's a good little point guard. I don't want to miss too many of his games. But obviously, the start of college season means I'm really excited.
How do you like your pizza, Fran? What are you going after tonight here?
You know, it's going to be a little sausage. I live in Dallas, Matt, and an unbelievable coincidence, a new pizza place opened up a mile from my house. The guy's from Brooklyn, where I grew up. And not only is he from Brooklyn, he's from the place that made my favorite pizza in Brooklyn. So 2,000 miles away, we've got a guy that's making authentic pizza, calzones, other Italian specialties, cannolis, and so I got to be really careful with the season underway. I can't gain any weight. I won't fit in my suits, but so good to have a fellow paisan from Brooklyn here in my neighborhood.
That's a hell of a get right there. That's great
stuff.
And good luck to your son here as he heads into the senior year. That's got to be pretty cool, though. I mean, before we get into the hoops news of the weekend, and there's plenty of it, what's it like to be a dad, a basketball dad like this, have a son, but obviously you're a known sports personality and obviously coach for so many years at the D1 level. So what's it like at this stage in your life getting to watch your kid enjoy the final, year of his high school days?
Well, it's been great. In fact, I've got a son who's a sophomore walk-on at Oklahoma for Juan Kruger.
Yep.
And so we took him through his senior year of high school. My senior, actually is potentially waiting on a chance to go to Harvard. You know, he's been to their camp. They're making sure that they can make the final decision on him, and he's got to get into school. But if not, he's got some really cool options at a lower level. He's a real good student. And honestly, Matt, as someone that was a coach for 23 years, one of the reasons ESPN has been such a great lifestyle for me and why I really never went back to coaching was because when I left coaching in 2002 at the University of New Mexico, my boys were 9 and 6. I figured it'd be cool to watch them grow up a little bit. And it's been so cool, and ESPN's created an opportunity for me that I've never gone back, in part because I've enjoyed being around my boys. And so Matt's a senior. He's almost done. And then my wife gets to come on some of these cool road trips to places like Allen Fieldhouse and Cameron Indoor Stadium. So it's going to be fun.
All right, so follow-up question here. My journalistic responsibility mandates that I ask you this. So you stopped coaching a decade ago because you had a couple of young boys. Now those boys are going off to college. So the fans want to know, are you definitely done coaching for the rest of your days here, or is there that infamous Michael Jordan, 1% chance that you return?
You know what? I'm like Vic Vermeil. You remember how long he was out? He was with ABC forever, and then he came back. I love ESPN so much, and I know how much you follow high school recruiting and obviously the college game. I don't know if I want to go back and do all that recruiting. I love recruiting when I was coaching, but the landscape's changed. It's a very tough environment. I missed the teaching and coaching on the floor. But quite frankly, like many of us who've gone on to ESPN who are coaches, it affords me a chance to coach without losing games. And so I don't know that my career is over from a coaching standpoint. I can only tell you I absolutely love the ESPN lifestyle. It lets me do what I want in the summer. I work the LeBron James camp. I get to travel to Europe and see the international guys. So it's a pretty good gig, and I don't want to screw it up. That's why I like, working as hard as I can to find out the next Nate Walters.
Okay. And that's a dynamite drop, name drop right there, Fran. Appreciate that, Nate Walters.
Well, that was for you, Matt. That was for you. You and I are we're of the same vein when it comes to our guy from South Dakota State. And interestingly enough, for 2 years in a row, I did their women's team in the NCAA tournament. So I'm familiar with Jackrabbit basketball. Let's
How
put
about
it that,
that?
Way.
Yeah, I ended up checking out Nate Walters over the weekend. I've got a story that'll be up Monday on the site about him.
Great.
And that program, and it's something else. We've had an incredible weekend of news, a lot of it off the court, and so we're going to hit on that.
Yep.
Now, the first thing I want to do is I wrote about this on the site Sunday. If you haven't gone to the blog, feel free to do so.
Yep.
North Carolina is, I feel like embroiled is the right term to use here. There's just been an academic scandal that's spread beyond the athletic department. It's gone into the academic corridors, and this is not new. I mean, this has been around for more than 2 years now. The NCAA was involved back in 2010, and as it stands right now, North Carolina is doing an internal review with the NCAA kind of lording over that, not necessarily digging its own hands in, but UNC is consulting with the NCAA. But basically, Dan Kame with the Raleigh News and Observer puts out a story late Saturday. There was a woman who used to work with players, and she basically saw plenty of instances, male and female, more than just basketball and football, where players were being afforded benefits of fraudulent grades or plagiarism on papers. And so basically it puts a name to a quote, and it really damages what Caroline is doing here. And so I can go a few different ways here, Fran, with you, but what I want to ask you is, what do you think the NCAA should do with Carolina first off? Because it's been dancing around this thing for about 2 years now. And in my opinion, I wrote, basically, it's similar to Penn State only in this. You had people in a higher, you know, higher heads at that university turn their head to something they knew what was wrong, you know, and Penn State got slammed rather immediately. What's the NCAA doing here, and what should it do in your opinion?
Well, it's very interesting. My colleague Jay Billis feels strongly about the fact that each school should police itself when it comes to academic standards, even to the point of determining whether players should be eligible or not, and make it not an NCAA deal, because we know how much fraud has gone on through the years with regard to test scores and otherwise. Now, having said that, I think it's incumbent on the institution itself. First of all, I think the NCAA did a terrible injustice to Penn State. I thought they overreached. I thought they overreacted. I think they acted too hastily, and they put their nose in a situation that I don't think they needed to go. I think they could have fined Penn State and made it a problem financially, but I don't think they should have hurt anybody in that football program who hasn't been associated with Jerry Sandusky. That's my feeling on that. Having said that, I think it's incumbent upon the University of North Carolina to deal with this situation straight on, because we all know, and I coached 23 years, we all know that there are going to be instances of particular teachers in courses, Matt, that are going to cut athletes slack. But this is so systematic and so invasive to the university and the credibility of the university that I think if it's not dealt with by the university, I think the NCAA ought to come in there. I really do. I just think that you can't have this kind of academic fraud going on. Now, it touches Roy Williams and the basketball program. It's a program that we know has got great success through the years, but I think you got to send a message. It's my opinion, and I feel this way about it. When somebody gets away with cheating or fraud, it costs somebody else their job. In other words, if North Carolina's had some guys that maybe shouldn't have been eligible, it means that Virginia and Wake Forest are losing games.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, and it's a way of putting it in perspective, because here's the other tough part with it, Fran, is obviously the current players, we can't operate under the assumption that any current players, football, basketball, what have you, are cheating in the same way that did or could have happened in the past. But they're the ones that are going to be punished. So it's always it's an unfortunate dilemma, really, with any school, not even just North Carolina. But those are kind of – that's just kind of the way it's got to be, right? I mean, it's not fair that if, you know – next year, for instance, Carolina gets docked, just to say, postseason play. Not saying that it will happen, but it could happen.
Understood.
You know? I mean, that's just those are just the breaks, right? And coaches, listen, you're a former coach. Coaches kind of get that's part of the deal, right? I mean, no one's naive enough to believe that that's not what they don't sign up for.
You know what, Matt? When you coach, and I have a lot of friends that are still coaching, obviously, you got the two little birdies on your shoulder. You got the one little birdie telling you what the right thing is, and you got the other little birdie telling you, hey, we can cut corners. It's the way it is. It's human nature, and I'm being dead level honest. I tried to be as upstanding as I possibly could. I try, you know, I've never involved in any kind of major cheating, and I've never even had a sniff of that with the NCAA. However, you're constantly wondering whether you should cut corners, even if it means keeping a player eligible. In one case at New Mexico, my best player was needing to pass a history of jazz class. I wound up studying the damn book with him and tutoring him. And I know more about John Coltrane and Miles Davis now than I ever thought I would. That's because I went out of my way to try to get the kid to make sure he buckled down. But the point is, I think it's incumbent upon North Carolina's university from the chancellor down to deal with this straightforwardly and head on. If there's been mistakes made, deal with them. If they affect the basketball program in the short term, so be it. But I don't think you can have this kind of academic fraud going on without any kind of punishment. Maybe what'll happen is it'll be dealt with from within and not ever, you know, because it's not under the purview of the NCAA yet. But given the fact that they stuck their nose in Penn State, I don't see why they don't have the authority to do it here.
That's basically what I wrote, and it is a tricky thing because grade fraud is something where the NCAA normally doesn't necessarily get involved because it can be such an institutional problem. But when you it's almost like, okay, if the NCAA, if the school itself doesn't do enough to punish itself, then as you're saying, the NCAA should step in. I'm arguing that's what needs to come now, specifically because of what they did with Penn State. Right or wrong, you're saying it's wrong. I totally get what you're saying on that as well. That's why I feel like they should act, and we should not be waiting come February. I wrote that we should know by Christmas what the NCAA feels about Carolina and what it's doing. One more quick thing to tag on this subject before we transition to Shabazz. As a coach, can you speak from experience about your players in the classroom? I know you just talked about the jazz class and everything, but keeping track of your players, what they're doing, and making sure they're doing things on the up and up. From your experience and talking with coaches today, how tough of a challenge is that truly? And this is I'm going to ask you to project a little bit here. How much do you think coaches might – a little bit just sit back and kind of hope? How many coaches do you think are truly embedded in knowing what their players are doing in classes? Because I feel like if they truly were, then you might have quite a few more players not academically eligible to play hoops.
It's tricky, you know, because every school is different. Every school has different standards. Every school has different majors. You know, we talk about hiding players in majors. To me, you know what, if you get a college degree, it's great. If you've earned it, whether you've taken a business or engineering, you know, which is a very difficult curriculum, or you got a general studies degree. You know, some kids, I'll tell you, Matt, just recently I had a young man I coached as an assistant at Ohio U. I'll try to make this story brief, but it was before Prop 48, so he tells you how long ago it was. We barely got him into school. His reading and writing ability was limited. He was from inner city Philadelphia. He wasn't a great player. We took him because the other player that we took from the same high school turned out to be an NBA player. But this young man struggled through school, started to figure it out, wound up graduating, wound up getting into graduate school at Ohio U, wound up getting a job in alumni affairs. The next thing I know, he's at Florida State in the development office where he's a fundraiser. Then to Syracuse. Right now he's assistant vice president at USC for fundraising and development. That would have never happened had he not gotten a chance to go to Ohio University some 27 years ago. Now, having said that, I think as a coach, you want the best for your players. You want them to try to do well. But sometimes you don't feel so badly if they're in a class that you know they can pass because you want to see them on the court, too. It's human nature. And I think you can have it both ways. You really can. But I got to tell you, my son at Oklahoma, they check every class. They have tutors. They have mandatory study hall. If you're a good kid at a BCS type of school with all that academic support, if you just try to go to class and do the right thing, you can be successful. That's where the coach comes in. Cajoling guys or getting guys that have that kind of character, even to say to them, look, we don't expect you to be Einstein, but just bust your tail in the classroom, sit up front. Pay attention. Don't fall asleep. Be nice to the teacher. Raise your hand on occasion, and you can do well academically. It's not that hard.
Love the honesty here. We're going to transition from one NCAA issue to another. To me, the North Carolina thing was the biggest headline of the weekend. In the here and now, it's probably Shabazz Muhammad, who got cleared late Friday. You know, I'm sitting there at the Garden covering a game, getting ready to, and all of a sudden I see Shabazz Muhammad is cleared at the 11th hour of a Friday, and I'm like, what is going on here? So, he's freed. He only had to serve 10% of his season, a 3-game suspension on a presumably 30-game regular season for UCLA. So he'll play Monday against Georgetown in Brooklyn. There are a lot of cynics out there on both sides of this, Fran. I want to know where you come down on the decision. It is an extremely interesting case here because, for full transparency's sake, there have not been many other players who have been so casually talked about how they have been illegally recruited. And I'm not just talking UCLA. I'm talking in general.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I had a coach. I had a coach tell me I didn't get involved with that kid because not only did I know there was a price, but I knew the exact price. So it's a very interesting thing here. A lot of times, Fran, these kind of cases, they're talked about in uncertain, vague terms. With Shabazz, it's a whole different idea. So what's your opinion on him getting eligible, him being at UCLA? Just, you know, vamp and explain what your side of it is here.
Well, I've talked to a bunch of coaching buddies who mirror the same sentiment. I'll just say this. I like Ben Howland. He's generally done things by the book. I think he's under a lot of pressure at UCLA to win. I'm not saying I know for sure what's going on, so I won't go there, but I know – I was very surprised that given what I did know about the background of the whole recruiting situation, that he was deemed eligible so quickly. And I have heard from a number of college coaches over the weekend that they said, and in large part, the NCAA knew that a potential lawsuit could be coming because of the investigator on the case. You're probably familiar with this. The boyfriend was on a plane talking about the case. A lawyer overheard it. It leaked out, and that the NCAA does not want a lawsuit. And so I think they kind of wiped their hands and said, go on ahead. And so I don't know that to be the case. I'm speculating, but I get paid to speculate, so that's my two cents.
By the way, I don't mean to interrupt you, Fran, but that little caveat, which is probably why he's eligible, makes this probably the most bizarre eligibility case I think I've ever heard of, definitely with any sort of high-profile recruit.
I agree. I mean, and I think, you know, there is a lot of smoke there. Again, I don't know for sure what was done illegally, if anything, but I do know from talking to a lot of people in the college game, coaches, people, you know, tried to get involved, there was a lot of smoke there. So, you know, now the interesting thing is Jordan Adams has been UCLA's best player. He's the best offensive player for sure. Now I think that while Ben Howland's got to be ecstatic about getting Shabazz Muhammad back, now there's no excuse. There's pressure on Ben to win big. So he's got his team in place, minus Larry Drew with this potential ankle injury. We'll see if he plays Monday. But now I think Ben Howland's got a job to do, and that is if he doesn't win at UCLA, you know, rather quickly, that they're going to be looking for a new coach in the short term. So
yeah, that's what to pay attention to going forward for sure.
Yeah, absolutely, because now he is going to play. So now let's see how good UCLA is, and is this kid the difference maker that we all think he could be? Because he's extremely talented. But I wonder what's going to happen to Jordan Adams, who's off to this great start. And obviously comes in slightly less heralded, obviously, than Anderson or Muhammad. So it'll be interesting dynamic with that team.
Yeah, absolutely interesting. I have concerns about their ability to just flat out defend. Josh Smith's ability to just shed weight has kind of been overshadowed in all this. UCLA is by no means guaranteed any sort of you know, Sweet 16 appearance, maybe not even a single-digit seed. We still have to – I mean, this team, granted they didn't have Shabazz, but they really got taken to the wire by Irvine. There are concerns. Exactly. You do a great job breaking down so many different kind of players. So real quick, for everyone that's heard the Shabazz name, the fans that listen to the podcast and watch the sport, they've heard Shabazz. They've never seen him, obviously. Can you just give people an idea of what kind of player he is? And, yes, the inevitable comparison, one or two guys in the past 5 or 10 years that you compare his game to?
Good question. You know, he's a 6 foot. First of all, I give him credit. He's a 6'5", solidly built kid who played with high energy. Okay. We use the term high motor, and I love guys like that. The kid does have a passion for the game. He does play extremely hard. Most of his game is to the rim in transition, attacking the glass off the dribble. His perimeter game is good, not unbelievable, but his athleticism and his ability to use that power to get to the basket, Matt, is definitely impressive. Let's put it that way. And he runs the court. He's a garbage man type scorer as well. So I just think his energy level, you know, I watched Marcus Smart over the weekend, and his energy is rubbing off on Oklahoma State right now. Not a really talented team. That's what Shabazz could bring to UCLA. Not so much the overall basketball IQ of Marcus Smart, but the fact that he does bring it every night. I've had one or two NBA friends tell me over the weekend they still now like Jordan Adams potentially as an NBA prospect, even over Shabazz, even though some people have Shabazz going number one, two, or three. What I love about him at the end of the day is just that he plays the game with great passion. He's a tremendous athlete, and he's going to be attacking the rim every chance he gets.
Interesting. Okay. Next big topic on we're recording this on Sunday night, but this is live on Monday. The biggest college sports news was probably Maryland and Rutgers flirting with the Big Ten. Maryland is apparently reportedly voting on the opportunity to switch from the ACC to the Big Ten. Rutgers could be doing the same by Tuesday. We don't yet know if either or both will go or not. And just when everyone just kind of kicks up their feet and wants to enjoy the end of the college football season, the start of college basketball season, this garbage comes into play again. I can get a little sentimental with this kind of stuff because, to me, the idea of Maryland not in the ACC is absolutely ludicrous. Obviously, they're only going to do it to chase money. And it's not – you can call it a football decision. It's actually a TV decision because Maryland in football just is not a historic program. It is a basketball school and is going to basically abandon that to cut ties, maybe, depending on where the vote goes, to go to the Big Ten. Where were you when you heard the news, Fran, and what's your overall reaction to the Big Ten trying to go to 14 and then possible implications with the ACC? You know, does it try and get UConn in then? What's it going to do?
Well, you know, I heard that over the weekend. I want to say it stunned me only because of the timing, but obviously it didn't stun me, Matt, because what's gone on the last 4 or 5 years on the part of college presidents and conference commissioners is absolutely disgraceful. But on the other hand, we know it's all about money, and money drives, and money in college football obviously drives college athletics. It's the way it is. I live in Dallas. I've seen the Texas A&M rivalry fall apart. Obviously, Kansas, Missouri, Syracuse, Georgetown. You go right down the list. Now Maryland and Duke, Maryland, NC State, Maryland, Carolina, if this does come to fruition. Rutgers needs a home. This is a great fit. They're the ones doing handstands tonight.
Yeah.
They wind up. I mean, they're going to vote themselves. They're going to vote to do this because it's a great opportunity for Rutgers. It's just the landscape of college athletics. And again, I get back to my colleague Jay Billis. I don't agree with everything Jay says, but he obviously makes a lot of sense on some things. And I think we're about to be heading towards 60 to 70 power conference teams that play college football that will bring basketball and some of the other high-profile non-revenue sports with them, Matt. I think that's where we're going. I think that we're going to have four or five power conferences at the highest level. And, you know, we might invite a handful of at-large teams that don't play at the elite level for the basketball tournament. But I think that these kind of decisions is where college athletics is headed.
Could be inevitable. Could be some sort of evolution, Darwinism at the college level. I think this is a dress rehearsal for that. I think we're still a solid decade away from that reality, but I don't reject the notion that it is heading toward that way. The final thing we'll touch on here, the other bit of big news from Friday that got lost in the sports cycle of news because so much happened in professional and college sports and everywhere else was Rick Majerus will not return to St. Louis, period. The plan was for him to take a year off from the team while he tried to get his health in order. He had a heart problem, has a heart problem, and after about a month and a half, 2 months of optimism and just going with a one-year away plan, St. Louis did release a statement Friday night that he will not be back it effectively ends his coaching career, as far as I'm concerned. Sadly, we're talking about a guy that is one of the most respected minds in the history of college basketball. He took Utah to the title game in 98. Yep. Would just love to get your thoughts on Rick as a coach. You obviously have a great perspective on him as a man, someone who's been at ESPN. Rick spent time at ESPN. You've run in the yep. same circles. Can you just talk a little bit about Rick for him?
Sure, I can, Matt. You know, it's funny. I was out at Mark Few's golf tournament in late August when we heard the news that Rick was going to, you know, take a leave. Two of his former assistants, Donnie Daniels, who's now at Gonzaga as an assistant, and Joe Cravens, the former head coach at Weber State, who was an assistant at Utah, are good friends of mine. They were at the golf tournament as well. And we heard the news. They both kind of knew on the inside that they didn't think Rick was back because this heart issue is very serious. So from that standpoint, I wasn't surprised. Kind of sensed this was coming. Rick was out of my mind, and I say that only in the fact that, you know, the season hadn't started yet. And then when St. Louis lost last week to Santa Clara, he popped back into my mind. The news didn't surprise me. A couple of quick anecdotes. I coached against Rick when I was at New Mexico and he was at Utah. Very good competitor, great coach. He didn't say a word to me, Matt, for 3 years, other than hello and goodbye. Shook my hand after games. When I left New Mexico and resigned, he was the first and only coach in that league, and they were all friends of mine, to call me and ask me if he could do anything for me. He's a very complicated guy. He'll rub some people the wrong way, and then he'll do some things behind the scenes charitably that you'll go, wow, that's such a great move. Tactically, he's one of the best coaches we've ever had. The guy's a near genius when it comes to the game. So obviously he'll be missed on the sideline. Now the key is for him to get healthy and hopefully maybe in a role on TV or as an observer of the game, still be a great teacher and ambassador because he is one of the great coaches that we've had in the last 25 years.
Can you give, you know, a lot of people toss that compliment out of Rick, rightfully so, that he's such a great basketball mind. I'm going to ask you to go inside basketball for a second. Can you give me some sort of anecdote or a way that people can understand a way he saw the game, a way he used his players in-game that gave him the kind of advantage that a lot of coaches either don't see or are slow to pick up. So just so people can understand, outside of the high praise, a specific of why he was so good and the things that he tended to do that other coaches just didn't see or just took longer to come around to.
Well, that's a great question, you know, and I'm glad you asked me because we often talk about guys who are, quote, near geniuses or great coaches and what makes a great coach, and there's a lot of different things, but what I think one of the ways, for example, Rick has always been a great coach is in the area of what I call scouting report defense. And by that, I mean he's going to take a look at the opponent, figure out what they do well, what their strengths are, and take those strengths away and make that team play what I call left-handed, play in a way that they're not accustomed to. And so how would he do that? If a team ran, let's say, 15 different offensive sets in the Utah locker room before that game against that opponent, every one of those plays would be on the board, on the blackboard, the diagrams of where players were to go on in those offensive sets. Then he would break down those plays on film with his team and show his team where the strengths were and how they were going to attack the strengths and take them away and make them weaknesses. Then they would go on the court and walk through those plays and show, and he would show his team exactly where they were going to switch a certain area or double team in a particular area, but we were not going to let their best players beat us. So on game night now, when you played them, you knew going in that whatever you did well, he had an answer for. So you had to now adjust to what he was going to take away. And one great example, because they were so good at taking away set plays, I used to tell my team the first 3 minutes of the game, we're going to play freelance. We're going to play with no plays the first 3 minutes because they expect us to run our offense and run what we would call motion offense instead, Matt. So there's a perfect example of what I think made Rick great, his ability to assess an opponent and make that opponent play to its weaknesses. Does that answer it?
Oh, yeah, that was good stuff. And I wanted to give you that opportunity because obviously we've talked about a few bigger picture issues here. You're a fine mind of the game yourself. And anyone looking for your savvy on teams and players can catch that on ESPN all throughout the season. By the way, follow Fran on Twitter. For anyone listening that is on the tweet machine and not following this this great man, do so. It's just at Fran Fraschilla, FranFraschilla. Rewind that playback two or three times if I said it too fast, but be sure to do that.
Exactly.
And you have a new assignment. You're doing Big Monday. Am I remembering that correctly?
I am, Matt. You know what? I'm back on Big Monday. You know, when you're at ESPN, you're in like the Yankee lineup, so they get to move you around. Sometimes you play second base. Sometimes you play right field, but it's always fun being
in
the lineup.
A-Rod you? Did they A-Rod you there for a second?
No, you know what? I've always considered myself Robbie Cano. Now, he's a star now, but when Robbie Cano came up, he was batting seventh, and I used to say, you know, I'm not Jay Billis, not Dickie V, you know, not none of those guys. I just want to hit. I don't care where you bat me in the lineup. Bat me seventh or eighth. I'm going to try to drive in 100 runs from the seventh spot. I'm very lucky. I'm back on Big Monday. Coach Knight's going to slide over to the SEC. Big Monday's been my home in the past. The Big 12 Conference is my home because I live in Dallas now. And I know all the coaches. It's really fun to be back. And I'm excited. I'm excited about, you know, being with Brent Musburger on Mondays. And as you know, the Big 12 is not the best conference in the country, but there's some great competition this year. Teams are getting better, and we should have some great ball games.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. And props to you for kind of, you know, stating the obvious there that the Big 12 is not the best. A lot of guys would kind of just prop up the league no matter what, so I appreciate that. And I've said this, you know, privately to other people, and not to make it a total love fest, but, you know, you're kind of owed this man-to-man on the podcast. You're truly one of the most valuable basketball minds, pro or college, that network has, you know, TV, online, no matter what. You know, you do such a great job, Fran, a total pro. And I can't wait to have you on back on the podcast. It was awesome to have you on for this first one. And we'll make sure we circle back around to you, you know, middle of the year. We can get your opinion on, you know, teams and players of the moment and give fans a chance to listen to you in that realm as well. All right, man?
Thanks, Matt. Really enjoyed it, and as you know I love following you as well. So any bits of basketball info I can pick up from guys like you, Goodman, Luke Wynn, Seth Davis, it's fun to trade stuff, and it's fun to follow the game all year and actually get people's different perspectives on the game. So, you know, kudos to you as well, and I look forward to being back.
Yeah, and you rightfully omitted Gary Parrish from that list. You're a smart man, and that was very savvy. Very much appreciated.
I got to throw Jason King in there just for good measure.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you so much. Everyone, again, thank you for listening.
Thanks,
you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Just search CBSSports.com College Hoops. It'll be right there under the podcast section. We will be back with our Wednesday show, Thanksgiving Eve. Jeff Goodman and Gary Parrish for their weekly Wednesday appearance will be there. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you then.